four chapters are going to basically be from 58 through 66. Now, based upon what he just did, he talked about this suffering Messiah, suffering servant, I'll call him that. So he's talking about this suffering servant that gives life to people, right? Because he dies, he will see his offspring, that kind of stuff. So that now is going to give rise to this Isaiah, Yahweh's deliverance. And that's what's the rest of this talk. Chapter 459 talks about a national confession of sin. 60 through 66 talks about a redemption of Zion. Now, remember, all this is based upon that suffering servant, right? Now, all of these restoration things can happen. Okay? 63 talks about Yahweh's day of vengeance, where and basically it talks about how no one else could deliver the people, so God had to come to do that. Well, we saw that that earlier in Isaiah 51:18, right? He looked around, couldn't find anyone to do it, so he brings his servant to do it. Okay? Same logic, I think. Then 53 through 64 is basically a lament where God is called upon to deliver them. And then 65, God will come to reign. And then the last chapter is basically this new heaven and a new earth. Do you realize that everything now is based upon that last suffering servant? Basically, I'll say those last three servant songs then give rise to this great redemption thing. Okay? Does that make some sense? So the structure of the passage, I think, holds together that way. Okay? Conclusions. What do we learn from the book of Isaiah? Remember I started this out, will Israel ever obey? What's the answer to that?
Yeah.
Yes. How long is it going to be?
A while.
Yeah. They're going to be, it's going to be at least 150 years before they're obedient to come back from Babylon, right? But this, it sounds like this, it's even going to go further, doesn't it? Because here we've got, if you remember that last chapter, it's talking about a new heavens and a new earth. God's going to have to do something. It hadn't happened yet to make this happen, right? So my guess is that we've still got some restoration coming that God will work out. And I actually think it's even in the nation of Israel. Okay? When you look at Revelation, it does talk about a group of people coming from Israel, 12,000 from every tribe, that will turn back to God. I do see that as a remnant that will come back. So the answer will be yes, but it's going to take a lot longer than we ever thought possible. Okay, second, does the historical situation help our understanding of the book?
Yes.
Why?
Because you can follow what Israel went through and how the prophecies of Isaiah came true.
There are certain passages that make no sense unless you know the context, right? Chapter 1, where it talks about a destruction and Jerusalem left, like a hut in a cucumber field. Would that make any sense unless you understood Isaiah, you know, what happened in 701? I don't think so. How about when you get to chapter 6 and he talks about two destructions that then give rise to a remnant? Well, unless you know about the first destruction of the northern kingdom being taken off into captivity, what was the date on that? 722? And then the second one being, but that's going to be subject to burning and it's going to be destroyed. When was that? 586. And then after that, there's going to be a holy seed, a remnant that's left. My guess is they think I think it's coming. Jeremiah's going to help us know who that is. But that's those people in Babylon that are going to come back, right? Were they a righteous lot when they came back? And why?
Because
how
they
did God
wanted
do
to.
It?
Because they wanted to come back.
Why?
To build the temple.
Why? Keep going, all that's right.
See glory of Babylon.
Okay.
They had everything else.
They had everything else, right? They had money, they had land, they had family. Why would they leave Babylon to come back to a ruined city? Unless it was to rebuild the temple. That's the only thing they didn't have in Babylon. So it makes perfect sense. Okay? All right. How about the chapter 40? Would you understand what chapter 40 meant unless you knew about them coming back in 539? Cyrus's decree? I don't think so. I don't think you'd understand that whole first part from 40 to 48 unless you understood that Cyrus was going to let them come back, would you? I don't think so. Okay? So do you see how the history and the book of Isaiah are intertwined? Unless you know the history, I don't think you can understand the book at all. I think it's left as bits and pieces, and I don't think it makes any sense. Okay? Isaiah is one of the worst ones, I think, for if you don't know the history, I don't see how you ever understand the book. Okay? So, but if you know the history, they fit together like hand in glove. Okay? All right, one more. Will Israel ever obey? Yeah? But it'll take some time, won't it? Okay, any questions on Isaiah? Well, I'm getting the next one ready. Do you see how the book holds together? Do you see why chapter 40, people, liberal scholars have a real problem with that? Because it's jumping 150 years? Okay. Do you see the idea of they call it a future deliverer being developed here? And then it comes into that suffering servant idea? Okay. All right, any other questions on that?
Does others link a suffering servant to anybody else?
Yeah, some of them linked him to Isaiah himself. But even he, it seems like to me, when he says we, he's linking himself. Of course, they would argue he's not writing it, but I would argue if he's writing it, it's got to be himself linked in there. Yeah. But then I've heard people say, look how badly Isaiah was treated. Well, the only way you get that is if you think he's that person, that suffering servant, which I'm not convinced he is. Okay? All right, let's look at Zephaniah, the day of the Lord. This won't take us long either. It's a small book. Oops. The day of the Lord. Let's look at it. Let's find it first. The concept of the day of the Lord begins to grow in the Old Testament, and by the time we get to Zephaniah, it's actually a time of cleansing, purging. That's the term that you have, a day of purging. Okay? Usually that's because the day of the Lord is going to be a fire that weeds out people. Okay? Remember it started in Amos, and they were longing for the day of the Lord. Why? Well, they thought that God was going to come and deliver them, didn't he? Well, little did they find out that they were part of the people God was going to purge and punish because they were so wicked. Well, when you get to Zephaniah, now he starts talking about this purging. Okay? Basically, it's two parts. Day of the Lord is judgment, then the day of the Lord is restoration. They wouldn't have known about this element of restoration unless God now starts to develop it, because Amos didn't tell them about it, much restoration in the day of the Lord. Now Zephaniah is starting to add that concept to it. Okay, so it's not just all judgment now. Okay? I've got a key verse down here. Therefore wait for me, declares the Lord, for the day when I will rise up to the prey. Indeed, my decision is to gather nations, to assemble kingdoms, to pour out on them my indignation, all my burning anger. For all the earth will be devoured by the fire of my zeal. Why would God do that? Well, he would do that if they've turned away from him and are rejected. He now has to get them back and purify them. That's what that purging is all about. Okay? Okay. Amos, the day of the Lord is destruction and punishment. Micah, that day is destruction and restoration for Israel, but they will be among the nations. It doesn't actually say it's them specifically. Zephaniah starts now saying, day of the Lord is destruction and restoration for all nations. So it's starting to say for everybody, not just Israel. Joel will actually say, the day of the Lord is destruction and restoration for those that are against God's people. So now it starts narrowing down that God's going to deliver his people. It hadn't had that concept yet. New Testament goes into great detail of the day of the Lord. Right now, you probably know a lot about the day of the Lord. And you know it because what Revelation talks about and all the development that leads up to that, right? Okay, so there is a progression on the idea of a day of the Lord. Purpose, announcing the coming judgment in the day of the Lord. It's got to be before the destruction of Nineveh in 612, because it talks about Nineveh. Historical background is a very bad situation with Manasseh and Ammon. Remember Manasseh, how wicked he is? Ammon, his son's not better. Not much better. The nice thing is Ammon, I think, just lasts a couple years. So that's probably the best thing about him. authors, there's no reason to question Zephaniah's authorship. There's nothing really in the book that tells you much about him. So I don't know of anybody that questions whether he wrote it or not. Zephaniah means God has hidden, or Yahweh has hidden. And I start to wonder if it means hidden his face from the nation of Israel so that it can be purged. That does make some sense in the book then. Okay? All right. Zephaniah actually looks like he's in the line of Hezekiah. Go to Zephaniah 1:1. Look what it says. The word of the Lord which came to Zephaniah, son of Cushi, son of Zedekiah, son of Amariah, and son of Hezekiah in the days of Josiah. Why do you think he makes that connection? He's connected to Hezekiah and Josiah. Well, it says it's in the days of Josiah, not necessarily he's connected. Why would he want to do that? What do you know about Hezekiah?
Good king.
Yeah, and it's in the days of Josiah. What does that tell you?
Good king.
Okay, he's another good king, but it's about halfway through before he starts this restoration. I wonder if Zephaniah was part of what led the people to start wanting this restoration. Okay? It very well could be.
I thought you had made the comment that it wasn't the people during Josiah. Mm-hmm. It really wasn't them that
right.
The hearts weren't in it.
It doesn't seem like it is. But that doesn't mean God's not going to send a prophet to try to help Josiah bring it. God usually at least enlightens them about the judgment and enlightens them to try to get them to change. And that's how come I see Zephaniah coming, is to try to get the people to change. But I don't see them changing much. At least it seems just outwardly anyway. Okay, let's go on. Basically, it talks about the day of judgment against Judah, and it lists Judah's sins. Look what it says about them. I'm going to start at verse 4. So I will stretch out my hand against Judah, against all the inhabitants of Jerusalem. I will cut off the remnant of Baal from this place. What's the remnant of Baal? You know who Baal is. What's the remnant of Baal?
Baal worshippers.
Yeah. And what would be the remnant of it?
What's left?
Yeah. Any of them that are left that are still serving Baal, he's going to cut them off, right? And the names of the idolatrous priests along with the priests, and those who bow down on the housetops to the host of heaven. Any idea what that host of heaven is? Lunar worship, stuff like that. Babylonians had a whole set of lunar worship things they did. Okay? And those who bow down and swear by the Lord and yet swear by Milcom. What's that? Who's Milcom?
Candy bar.
Is it?
Milky Way.
Who is it? Okay, God from where? Does anybody know? I believe it's Moab actually has Milcom as one of their gods. So why is God so upset when they swear by Yahweh and yet swear by Milcom?
Because he can't be divided.
Okay, here's the key. These guys are worshiping two gods, aren't they? And God gets really upset with that. Okay? Those who hate, who have turned their back on following Yahweh, you can see why he's ticked at them. And those who have not sought the Lord or inquired of him. Yeah.
You skipped two, but, I mean, is that hyperbole?
Verse 2? Or what?
Yeah.
Yeah. I will completely remove all things from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I assume it is hyperbole, but at some point, I think he is going to do that. Remember in Isaiah, it just talked about he's going to make a new heaven and a new earth. Maybe it's getting at that.
I never thought about that. I mean, even the animals are dead. Everything's just...
Yeah. Yeah. So it could be pointing towards that. Because remember, Zephaniah is talking about the day of the Lord when God does all this judgment. So it's looking forward to that time. So that would make some sense. Look at the next one. Look at verse 9. I will punish on that day all who leap on the temple threshold. That might even be leap over the temple threshold. What does that remind you of? Does anybody remember? Who did that?
Philistines.
Why? I guess it came from that step on a crack, you break your mother's back kind of stuff.
That's when, yeah. Was that when the gods fell?
Uh-huh. Remember Dagon?
Dagon
falls on the threshold and it broke off his head and his arms? These people, apparently, because it says from then on, they would never step on the threshold. I'm wondering if that's what this is getting at. So foreign gods like that. Okay? There will be a sound of a cry from the fish gate, a wail from the second quarter, a loud crash from the hills. Basically what that sounds like is that destruction is coming, and so these people are crying out, and it looks like it's coming to one gate, then it's coming to the next gate. And so it looks like Jerusalem is going to be overwhelmed by this destruction. I think that's what it wants you to know. Okay? Look at verse 12. It will come about at that time that I will search Jerusalem with lamps. I will punish the men who are stagnant in spirit, who say in their hearts, the Lord will not do good or evil. Do you see what they're saying? They're not that he won't do good, and not that he won't do evil. I think they're thinking he can't do anything. He can't do good or evil. Well, he's going to punish them. That's why they're stagnant in spirit. They don't think God can do anything. Okay? Then it goes on, it talks about, look at verse 15, a day of wrath is that day, a day of trouble and distress, a day of destruction and desolation. So basically it's talking about a destruction that's going to be brought, right? In chapter 2, 4, he starts talking about the different countries that are going to be punished. So the first chapter is how Judah's going to be punished. Then Judah's enemies will be punished. Okay, so it talks about, look at verse 3 of chapter 2. Seek the Lord, all you humble of the earth, you have carried out, who have carried out his ordinances. Seek righteousness, seek humility. Perhaps you will be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger. Is that possible? Why he's called Zephaniah? Maybe you will be hidden? That may be where his name comes from. Okay? All right, for Gaza will be abandoned, Ashkelon will be desolate, Ashdod will be driven away at noon, and Ekron will be uprooted. All those are Philistine cities. They're all going to be destroyed. It then goes on, talks about Moab. Look at verse 8. I've heard the taunt of Moab and the revelings of the sons of Ammon with which they have taunted my people and become arrogant against their territory. So now they're going to be punished. Surely Moab will be like Sodom, the sons of Ammon like Gomorrah. So Israel's enemies are now going to be punished. Okay? Look at verse 11. The Lord will be terrifying to them, for he will starve all the gods of the earth, and all the coastlands of the nations will bow down to him, everyone from his own place. Now he's going to Ethiopia. Look at verse 12. You also, O Ethiopians, will be slain by the sword. So God, and then it later talks about Assyria. Look at the next one. Nineveh, a desolate place, like a parched wilderness. Notice he's going to get, look at verse 15. This is the exalted city which dwells secretly, who says in her heart, I am and there is no one beside me. That how she will become desolate, a resting place for beasts. Everyone who passes by her will hiss and wave his hand in contempt. My guess is it's talking about Nineveh. It's in the same context, right? How boastful Nineveh was. And I think that's probably what's going to happen. Nineveh will be destroyed. Okay? Then it goes to, so it goes basically through all those. Then it goes to chapter 3, and it goes back to Jerusalem. It talks about she's rebellious, defiled, she heeds no voice, accepting no instruction. She did not trust in God, her princes devoured. So it basically goes through. Look at verse 5. The Lord is righteous within her. He will do no justice. Every morning he brings his justice to light. He does not fail, but the unjust knows no shame. So my guess is that the Lord's going to do some judging, and Israel won't get it. Okay? All right. That's enough there. Let's keep going. In chapter, in verses 9 through 21, it talks about Yahweh's restoration to the nations. Look at verse 9 and 10. For then I will give to the peoples purified lips. Notice it's not just people, it's peoples. And all of them will call in the name of the Lord to serve him shoulder to shoulder beyond the Euphrates. My worshippers, my dispersed ones, will bring my offerings. In that day you will feel no shame. For I will remove from your midst your proud exalted ones, and you will never again be haughty on my holy mountain. Do you see what happens? This remnant that's coming is not going to be just Israel, is it? It's going to be nations. Okay? Look at verse 12. But I will leave among you a humble and lowly people. They will take refuge in the name of the Lord. A remnant of Israel will do no wrong and tell no lies, nor will this a deceitful tongue be found in their mouths. For they will feed and lie down. So the remnant will be in Israel too, and they will be a righteous remnant. Okay?
But those are the ones that came back.
Who will be the ones that came back?
The remnant.
I don't know that this is talking about the same one. This sounds like it's in a punishment that's going to happen. So my guess is it's probably referring more to the destruction that's in 586, and then a righteous remnant will come back after that, which did.
What I mean.
Yeah.
There's a remnant that was left.
Yeah, but I don't think it's only them. Did you see it talks about nations coming to God? That usually, and it's talked about in the day of the Lord, my guess is that this is future time, that when this restoration will take place.
So it's beyond?
I think so, 539, I think it's beyond that. Because I don't think at that time we saw nations coming to him, right? I'm not even sure we saw a total destruction like we're going to see in the future, so which the day of the Lord talks about. See, what's kind of neat is the day of the Lord. You now know a lot about it. In my understanding, when the New Testament talks about the last days, plural, it means from the time of Christ all the way to the end. Okay? When it talks about the last day, singular, it's basically that time of judgment right at the end. Okay? But when it's plural, days, it means from Christ's death on. Okay. My guess is that even this day of the Lord is talking about that time frame. Okay. Now you know about a lot, quite a little about what's going to happen specifically in that day of the Lord. Yeah.
Why would, it just seems like it's so long off from their time frame. I mean, we haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I haven't yet.
And yet, in their day, this is written. Mm-hmm. It just seems like, they couldn't even fathom. And not that we can fathom it either. But it's just so far off. It's like way out there in the blue millennium.
And that makes some sense. Remember Isaiah even talks about a new heaven and a new earth. As far as I know, that hasn't happened yet, but I still think it's going to. Well, I think God gives the big plan. He's telling these people the big picture of what he's going to do.
In a sense, they're in the hope.
And my understanding is that this is what kept them alive. Like in Jesus' day, I think they were looking forward to these kind of days of the Lord kind of thing. And we're still looking for them. I think God purposely didn't give them the timing because he wanted them always to be ready. That's why I don't think he gives you that specific dates. Because I think he wants them always to be ready.
So this would definitely indicate Israel's coming back into the picture and the church hasn't taken.
As far as I can see, that's true. Yeah. And even if, I think even if you were covenantal and argued that the church has taken Israel's place, you either have to take these very, very figuratively, which some of them do, or you'd have to see at least a part for Israel at the end. So you not only have the church coming back, but you still had Israel too. Some people are now trying to blend them a little.
Or they just give up and think they were wrong all along.
I think everybody tries to blend, we're in an age of compromise. What can I say? All right. So basically, you've got a restoration now at the end. He talks about nations. We already talked about that. He talks about a remnant of Israel coming back. That was in like 11 through 13. But then he's going to talk about a glorification of Zion. Look what it says. Shout for joy, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O Israel. Rejoice and exalt with all your heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. The Lord has taken away his judgments against you. He has cleared away your enemies. The King of Israel, the Lord, is in your midst. You will fear disaster no more. In that day, it will be said of Jerusalem, do not be afraid, O Zion. Do not lift up your hands, do not let your hands fall limp. The Lord your God is in your midst, a victorious warrior. He will exalt over you with joy. He will be quiet in his love. He will rejoice over you with shouts of joy. I will gather those who grieve about the appointed feast. They who came from you, O Zion, the reproach of exile is a burden on them. See, as you can see, these people, if they grieve over the appointed feast, that probably means there are remnant people that care. And that's what I think this is getting at. Behold, I'm going to deal at that time with all your oppressors. I will save the lame, gather the outcast, and I will turn their shame into praise and renown in all this earth, in all the earth. At that time I will bring you in, even at that time I will gather you together. Indeed, I will give you renown and praise among all the peoples of the earth. Then, or when I restore your fortunes before your eyes, says the Lord. See, this is what I think the nation is looking forward to. And I don't think this has happened yet. But notice, it's really talking about a glorification. It's got to be those in those last days. Okay? All right, any questions? Oh, let's see. Let's ask some questions. What's the purpose of the book?
Hope.
Hope for what?
A future that they're never going to see.
And at least these people he's talking to. But it is hope still, isn't it? Okay? What do we learn about God in this book?
Don't take him on.
Okay, don't take him on. All right, what else?
I think that he's he's faithful to continue on.
Yeah, he's got the bigger picture in mind, doesn't he? Even though we may not, he does see the big plan. What else?
He does care for all the people.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it just Israel he cares about? No. You just found out that there's going to be a remnant from the nations or the peoples, right? Not just from Israel. Does he care about Israel? Well, yeah. He started with them. It sounds like he still has a plan. But that's not all he cares about. Do you know what's funny? Even in the New Testament, remember how the scribes and Pharisees didn't want Gentiles to come into the church? Remember? They didn't want Gentiles to become Jewish. Well, isn't that funny? Because all throughout, at least significantly in the Old Testament, he talks about nations, peoples coming to him. Not just one. See, what I think is interesting is that God lays the foundation. Originally, remember, he had said, I will make you a nation of priests. You'll be the go-between between me and the other nations. In actual fact, they did such a bad job of that that it looks like to me God is going to make it happen even in spite of them in the future. At least that's how I understand it. I understand it that one of these days, he will make Israel be a light to the nations. They may not even want to, but when he starts working with them to make them a remnant and they start coming back to him, nations will see that and they'll want some of it too.
That's what always bothered me about Jesus is that, I mean, he came to the Jews and he sent his disciples out to the Jews first. And it was ignore the Gentiles.
At least at first, yeah.
Which, I mean, if that's how Christ himself was, I can see where the Pharisees would get this idea of,
sure.
I mean, because Israel is God's chosen people.
And see, I see a change in about Matthew 12, where up to that point, it's pretty much offered to Israel. Then Israel seems to reject it, and then they're sent out to those beyond Israel. So I do see a change, what looks like a change in his plan. So the offering is to Israel, but then it looks like it's going to be broader than that. And even this foretold that. I mean, this was already laying the foundation for that. Okay, any other questions, comments?
You said that as if Israel would have accepted it, then it wouldn't have been extended.
Well, I think if Israel would have accepted it, he would have set up his kingdom at that point, and then people probably would have wanted to come. Remember, you still got the idea of the other nations seeing this. Remember in Isaiah where it said nations are going to stream up to Jerusalem because they want to know their God? See, that's kind of how I see this. When God starts pouring out his blessing on Israel, they're going to say, look at that God, I'd like a part of that. And I think that's why they'll want to come. Does that make some sense? So kind of like what was in Isaiah 12 or 11 when it says that nations will stream, they'll want to know about your God. So I see this as kind of the same kind of thing.
But I look at it as basically God gave them, God knowing, in a sense he worsened their condemnation because they got that last shot and they rejected him. It almost made it worse.
Well, at least now they know they're guilty.
And that actually because, or again, we can't necessarily say Israel totally rejected God because the 12 disciples were all Jewish and
sure.
they started the church. But I think today, I mean, nations strain to that God of Israel, and that Israel's totally rejected. Yeah. Nations are still, we strain to it.
And my guess is it's going to even get more as it gets closer to the end, don't you? As I understand. And then at one point, Israel even will come back. At least that's how I understand it.
Well,
or at least the what?
I don't see it becoming more until he makes every knee and tongue confess.
Well, yeah.
I mean, to me, that's when it becomes totally obvious that.
Yeah. Yeah. But it does talk about in the tribulation, people apparently will turn back. They'll realize that they made mistakes too, and that might be mostly Israel, but I think it's also be Gentiles too. Some of them. Okay, one more. Is there any new concept about the day of the Lord that we learned? One thing that I don't remember in any of these others speaking about the day of the Lord is that now Israel's enemies are going to be punished. That seems to be a new element that I hadn't seen before. Okay, so it does sound like when we went through Ammon and Moab and all those guys going to be punished, I hadn't seen that before. So it does seem like that's a new element to Zephaniah. Okay, so the concept is building. Okay, that was easy. I can get through these little books really easy. Habakkuk is the next one. Basically, this has got to be before 612. Anybody know why? What happens in 612? Nineveh falls. Who destroys them? Or at least punishes them at that point? Good. Babylon. Okay? So in 612, the Babylonians come and wipe out Nineveh. They aren't done yet, though. They then flee to a place called Carchemish. No, actually, first Haran in 609, and then in 605, Carchemish. At Carchemish, they finally get so destroyed that they don't come back. Okay?
Yeah. I was thinking about that today, though, because the Muslims, the Saddam Hussein, I mean, the Iraq, Iran, I mean, those are the descendants of these people.
Assyrian?
Of the Babylonians, of the Assyrians.
Yeah.
So they were, I mean, if God had totally destroyed them, we wouldn't be in the pickle we were today.
Well, not exactly. There are actually still people that are called Assyrian today. Actually, when I was at Moody, I actually had an Assyrian person. So there is a group in Iran or Iraq that are called Assyrian, legitimately. So there are a small group of them still left. Not many that I know of. And usually they're persecuted too in Iran.
They have a different language.
I think they do. It comes from Persian, if I remember. Yeah. So there still must be some left. So it's not totally destroyed, but enough that there are very, very few.
Well, then who are the peoples there today descended from?
I think that they are in... some Arab tribes that have infilled the land. I don't think they're necessarily indigenous. At least not all of them. Okay, Habakkuk I'm going to call Confident Faith in Uncertain Times. Basically, what I'm going to argue is the book of Habakkuk. In the book itself, Habakkuk changes. Okay, and I want to show you that. Part of the reason is that the fear of the Babylonians coming changes him. Okay? Let's look at it. In the book of Habakkuk, there are three cycles. Two cycles and one prayer. Okay? What I call a cycle is Habakkuk laments, God responds. Then Habakkuk laments again, God responds. And then, at the end, you've got Habakkuk's prayer. Okay? At the very beginning, it seems like Habakkuk is a real mouthy little prophet. By the end, he's actually changed. Oh, I'll show you. I'll show you in a minute what he says.
Well, is it good for God's prophet to be mouthy?
Well, I guess not. At least, well, Jonah learned that he was pretty mouthy at first by running. But Habakkuk, well, let's look at what Habakkuk says. All right. We know very little about Habakkuk. Okay, the book doesn't give us much. It has to be before 612 because it says that Nineveh was a great city. Okay, now we know about that. Jonah, that same language is used for that. Okay, so this has to be before they're captured by the Babylonians. Okay, in verse 6, look what it says. For behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people. Who are the Chaldeans? Yeah, the Babylonians. So it sounds like the Babylonians aren't raised up yet, but he is going to do that. Okay? So that's what, I actually date this actually before 612, but even before 626, because in 626, that's when Nineveh starts losing power and the Babylonians start gaining power. So I think it's got to be somewhere between that time. Okay? Purpose. Habakkuk learns to wait and trust in God who works all things out for his glory. We'll look at that, but that's the big idea. All right, his first complaint. Look at this, verse 1. How long, O Lord, will I call for help and you will not hear? He's saying God's not listening, right? Okay?
But this is an oracle that he saw.
Yeah. Okay, so what does that mean?
But isn't the whole thing a vision or a prophecy that he...
And not necessarily. I mean... My guess is that part of this is an interaction with God.
If God is using him, God jumps off that question to prophesy to his people.
Yeah, true.
I have an affinity for mouthy people. I don't think I like
people. But look what he says. He says that God's not listening, right?
Yeah.
And he calls out violence, yet you do not save. So basically he's saying he's not responding either. But look what he says next. Why do you cause me to see iniquity and cause me to look on wickedness? Yes, destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists and contentions arise. Therefore, the law is ignored and justice is never upheld. For the wicked surround the righteous, therefore justice comes out perverted. What's he saying?
I think he's making an honest observation.
Okay. What is that honest observation?
It appears God's not doing it.
Okay, I'm going to actually argue he goes one step further. I think he's saying, God, I think you're doing a lousy job of running this world. If I was doing this, I wouldn't let those wicked get away with that.
That sounds like Jonah.
Yeah, except this one actually seems like it gets a little more mouthy.
I appreciate that, because God's never been threatened.
Oh, I don't think God has any problem with any threats. But I think God, Habakkuk is mouthing off to him.
That's okay.
We'll see. We'll see. Even he knows at some point it's not okay. I'll show you. All right. Here's God's response. So God's Habakkuk's response is, I don't see you responding. I don't see you listening. And in fact, I don't like the way you're doing things. Well, look what God says. Look among the nations. Observe. Be astonished. Wonder. Because I'm doing something in your days you would not believe even if you were told. Do you see what he's saying? I am listening, I am doing something, and I do a good job of running the world. He's going to tell them that in a minute. Do you see? But it's not the way Habakkuk would have done it. Look what he says. For I am raising up the Chaldeans, a fierce and impetuous people, who march through the earth and seize dwelling places that are not theirs. They are dreaded and feared, and their justice and authority originate with themselves. Look at verse 10. They mock at kings, and rulers are a laughing matter to them. They laugh at every fortress and heap up rubble to capture it. Then they will sweep through like the wind and pass on. But they will be held guilty, they whose strength is their God. You see what he's saying? I'm doing a good job of running the world, and in fact, even those wicked people that are punishing, they will be held accountable.
But go on.
Yeah, I was going to say, he makes a very good to keep your mouth shut.
No, only in Isaiah. Hey.
Oh. Okay.
But you try to sweep through these little books like they're not. He makes a very good point next, too, though.
Oh, hang on. Okay, so basically, in God's response, Oh, I'm sorry. I should show you what Habakkuk's feeling. He doesn't think God cares or he's not interested in him. I must not be very important to God because otherwise he'd listen to me. Shouldn't God come when I call? Doesn't God care about this rampant sin around us? And it just keeps getting worse. That's kind of what Habakkuk's thinking. Okay? His God is uninterested, too busy to care about Habakkuk, and he doesn't care about the wickedness around him. Yeah.
Would it be a shock to Habakkuk that God said the Babylonians or the Chaldeans?
Yes, I think so. Because at this point, I don't know that he knows much about them, but he probably knows they're starting to gain power. And God tells him, actually, this picture of the Chaldeans is actually a really good picture of what they're like. They're impetuous, they do a good job, they punish people, they laugh at kings. I mean, he gives them a good illustration of what they're like.
Yeah.
Let's keep going. God's response is, I am listening, I'm doing what, that even if something, if I told you, you wouldn't believe it. Second response, I'm acting and I'm sending the Babylonians. Third, I do a perfect job of running the world. The Babylonians are efficient and thorough, but they will be punished. So basically, he answers every one of his questions. Okay? For comment.
But heck?
Is
no, he's not wrong. I don't know anybody that hasn't ever felt like that at some time in their life. The psalmist wrote, I think it's 77.
Sure.
That his foot almost slipped because he felt like the wicked would prosper.
Sure. Hang on. There's one place where I think Habakkuk realizes he's gone too far. Let me show you that. Okay, so that's God's first response. Then Habakkuk says, look at verse 12. You are from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One. We will not die. I actually think that's a question. We will not die, will we? See, he says God's from everlasting. He doesn't have to worry about that. But what about us? We don't live forever. Okay, so I think he's thinking somebody could get hurt in this. Us! Okay? Second problem. Look at verse 13. I want to read a little. You, O Lord, have appointed them to judge. You, O Rock, have established them to correct. But your eyes are too pure to approve evil. And you do not look on wickedness with favor. Why do you look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they?
Amen.
Well, look at Habakkuk's wickedness chart. Here's Israel on this side. They serve Yahweh. They don't overthrow other nations. But look at the Babylonians. They serve other gods. They wipe out other nations and don't spare anyone. See, in their mind, this is easy. In Habakkuk's mind, this is easy. Certainly the Israelites are better, aren't they? Well, wait a minute. God's righteousness chart's a little different. It says all our righteousness is as filthy rags. Israel's on this side. They know better, but they still don't follow God. The Babylonians are on the other side. They don't know any better, so they serve power, money, and whatever comes along. Which one is more guilty?
I still don't think it makes it okay for God to use evil.
I'm sorry. He does. He used the Assyrians earlier.
I'm saying I have as much problem as Habakkuk had.
Yeah, okay, well, we'll fix you in a minute. Okay, we'll get to his prayer.
And just said he called it the northern one, Gary.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, but do you see this? Do you see, it is, I think in my mind, I think it's unfair for Habakkuk to say, why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? In actual fact, he probably assumed Israel was the more righteous. But I actually have to tell you, by Habakkuk's time, they're sinners and they're turning away from God. God deserves to punish them. He had already wiped out the northern kingdom, right? It's about almost time for the southern kingdom to be wiped out. So where's their righteousness?
But it's such, to me, forgive me, Lord, it's such twisted logic. I mean, when Israel first came in, they were sent in to destroy nations. Babylon didn't exist, but just like Babylon.
True.
Whose time was up. And as you said, Israel's never been particularly righteous, and yet they were still sent in to as God's judgment.
True.
And
I think
instead of God...
Look at the key. But they will be held guilty, they who strengthen their God.
Absolutely. But it just doesn't seem right for them to have this period of prosperity and apparent happiness.
The Babylonians. I'll let you talk to God about that.
Oh, I will.
Hang on, let me show you what I'm Okay, I want to read, look at verse 14. Why have you made men like fish of the sea, like creeping things without a ruler over them? The Chaldeans bring up them with a hook, drag them away in their net, and gather them together in their fishing net. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. In actual fact, we found out, this is very literal, the Babylonians would put hooks in people's nose and lead them off into captivity. They also had nets, leather nets that they put their captives in, and then they would parade them through the streets of Babylon. That we know that this is very literal. Look at verse 16. Therefore they offer a sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their fishing nets, because through these things their catch is large and their food is plentiful. He's basically saying, these guys don't even know any better, right? Will they therefore empty their nets continually without slaying, and continually slay nations without sparing? I even think Habakkuk just knows he went too far. When he just challenged God and said, why are you silent while the wicked swallow up more those more righteous than they? And when he gets down to here, look what he says, verse 2:1. I will stand on my guard post and station myself on the rampart. I will keep watch and see what he will speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved. I think he thinks he's going to be reproved. Why?
But
he mouthed off to God.
He says, how I may reply when I'm reproved. I think he's saying, bring it, I'm still going to have a response.
I think he thinks he knows he's going to be punished.
I don't think you know mouthy people.
That's funny. I am one, so I think I do know. I would have expected at this point to God, for God, see, I've got that part already. I would have expected at this point God to slap him. Wouldn't you?
No.
Here's a mouthy prophet, and I think he deserves slapping. And he even says, I'll wait until I am punished and see what I will respond after I'm punished.
Amen.
Look what God does.
Look
what God does. The Lord answered me and said, record the vision and inscribe it on tablets, that the one who reads it may run. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, it hastens towards the goal, it will not fail. Though it tarries, wait for it. For it will certainly come, it will not delay. What's God saying?
I'm giving you a 5-minute head start.
No, well, if it was only a 5-minute head start, I might write it down. Notice what he's saying, though? That it's going to be some time before it comes, and that's why I get ready for it, though. I actually think this is necessary. I think this is what changes Habakkuk. It's in this time period here of knowing judgment's coming and having to wait for it that Habakkuk seems to change. Okay? Look at verse 4. Behold, oh, I've got this. Here it is. Behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him, but the righteous one will live by his faith. Who's this referring to?
Those in Judah who are still righteous, who trust God.
Okay. Who's the proud one?
That's probably Babylon.
Yeah, probably Babylon, but who else?
Habakkuk.
I think Habakkuk fits into that category.
No.
I do.
No.
Why is it? Because he's not trusting in God, right? He's telling God he doesn't like the way things are going on. I think he fits in that category too.
He has a legitimate question.
We'll see.
And God uses his legitimate question and has it recorded and in his word.
I think at this time he needs a reproof. And I think he's going to get it. Look at what happens. The New Testament uses this book, 3 times in the New Testament. And each time it emphasizes a different element of that little phrase. The righteous one will live by faith. In Romans, it's emphasizing the righteous aspect. In Galatians, it talks about the righteous one shall live, the idea of the living by it. And then Hebrews, the righteous one shall live by faith. It emphasizes the faith aspect. That's actually kind of neat. An Old Testament passage is used in 3 different ways in the New Testament, even using the same phrase, okay? But emphasizing different aspects. God has 5 woes for the Babylonians. Basically, the first one is, woe to him who increases what is not his. Okay? because what's going to happen, he will become plunder. Next one, woe to ones who devise evil plans, they're going to perish in those evil plans. Woe to him who kills others, verse 12. Okay? Who builds a city with bloodshed. What's going to happen is their evil plans will come on themselves. Woe to those who make advances on and take advantage of others. Look at verse 15. Woe to you who make your neighbors drink, who mix in your venom, even to make them drunk, so as to look on their nakedness. So it sounds like they're taking advantage of them. And then verse 19 is woe to those who worship idols. Look what it says. Woe to him who says to a piece of wood, awake, to a mute stone, arise. And what is your teacher? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there's no breath in it at all. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. Do you see what's going on? He's contrasting himself with those false idols, but instead, God is the one that's in control. Okay? You can see that. Okay. Starting at chapter 3, it sounds like things have changed. Look what he says. Now remember, this is not, my guess is that this all isn't one book. He just sat down and wrote it all. My guess is that he wrote parts of this. This Psalm 3, or I'm sorry, this passage, Habakkuk 3, is basically a psalm of trust. And you can actually look, it follows this exact structure of a psalm of trust. Okay? And notice it starts out a prayer of Habakkuk, the prophet, according to the Shiganoth. Well, the only other place you see that image, that idea of a Shiganoth used is in the Psalms. And then notice at the end, look at the end of the book. It says, for the choir director, unstringed instruments. The only other place you see that is in the Psalms. So I'm pretty sure that this prayer of Habakkuk is in the structure of a psalm. And I think it's after he's thought about it, and now he relies on God. Look what he says in verse 2. Lord, I've heard the report about you, and I fear. What's that mean?
I totally disagree with this.
I don't care. I'm teaching, not you.
God doesn't answer him. Number one. God's answer is, dude, don't worry about it. The Babylonians are going to get theirs. And Habakkuk's response in 3 is, great. Now I'm wet in my pants. Okay, I was worried before. Now I'm scared to death. And he's asking God for mercy. He's saying, can't you cut us some kind of break? Can't you cut us some kind of slack? I don't see his change of attitude here like you
look
did.
At verse, you go to chapter 3, yeah. Verse 1. Lord, I've heard about you and I fear. What's that actually tell you?
That God said in his judgment that he's going to destroy the Babylonians, but he's going to use them to destroy us first.
Okay.
I would be afraid. I would say, okay, God, I heard what you said. I'm scared to death.
Good. I think that's what's going to change Habakkuk. I can show you by the end, he's a changed person. Right? I mean, you'll see the change in him. That's the first one. Look at verse 2. O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. What's that mean? What's it mean, O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years?
I think bring us back to you. Bring.
Okay. What are some of the works in the past?
Miracles. That God brought him out of Egypt.
Okay. Those are the things I'm thinking about. His great acts where he delivered the nation, right? So he's saying, revive those. Make them happen again.
Right. Deliver us from the Babylonians.
Yeah. In the midst of the years, make it known. So let me see it, right? Then the last one. In wrath, remember mercy. What's he saying?
We won't all die, will we? Same thing.
Okay.
Earlier.
So I actually think he has a new reverence for God, a new faith, because he wants to see God do it, and a new attitude. I think it's funny when he says, in wrath, remember mercy. That's God all over, right? God always shows mercy in his wrath. And I think that's what he's asking for, so I think that's kind of cute. I think God's going to do that. I don't think that's a question. The next, probably 10 verses are basically going to be an image of God coming in deliverance. It uses images. Let me get it here. Oh, I'm sorry. It uses images from the last time Israel was saved in the Exodus. Most of these are a picture of him being a valiant warrior coming to save his people. He destroys all his enemies in verses 8 through 11. Most of the quotes and illustrations come right out of Exodus.
Verse 5, the worm goes pestilence and plague comes after it.
Actually, that one, do you remember? I would argue that could be in the Exodus imagery when he was doing to the Israelites, the Egyptians.
But now he's going to do it to Israel.
It would give them plagues and...
You're going to destroy them with the Babylonians.
Let's keep going. I saw the tents of Cushan. Remember, that's one of the nations that actually Israel went by. The tents of curtains in the land of Midian. That's when another nation that they had gone by. In your wrath against the sea, you rode on your horses, on your chariots of salvation. Your bow was made bare. When it says your bow was made bare, it means you were shooting arrows. Okay? The rods of chastisement were sworn. You cleaved the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and quaked, and downpour of water swept by. Verse 12. In indignation you marched through the earth. In anger you trampled the nations. Verse 14. You pierced with your own spears the head of the throngs. They storm in to scatter us. Their exultant was like those who devour the oppressed in secret. You trampled the sea with your horses in the surge of many waters. So here's God coming to bring deliverance. Look at verse 16. I heard and my inward parts trembled. At the sound my lips quivered, decay entered my bones, and in my place I trembled, because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people who arise to invade us. I actually believe that fear is changing Habakkuk, and that sometimes it's good to be afraid, because I think this fear is what's going to bring on the next. Look what it says in verse 17. Though the fig tree will not blossom, and there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold and there be no cattle in the stall, yet I will exult in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. He has made my feet like hind's feet and made me walk on high places. What's that mean?
He's going to trust in God.
He is.
Even though God destroys him.
I think even though he doesn't see any reason why he should trust, I think he's gonna. Right. Why? Because he has nothing else to draw on, does he? Right. Here's the Babylonians that are coming against them, and I think he has got no other choice than to rely on God. I think he's a changed person. At the beginning, did you see trust in Habakkuk?
He was asking a legitimate question. And God responded, and God didn't. As far as I'm concerned, God doesn't respond. I mean, look at Job. God doesn't answer.
God did answer.
He didn't answer any of the questions that were asked. He simply said, don't worry about the Babylonians. He didn't say, okay, Habakkuk, I'll give Israel another chance to repent. I'll give you an opportunity or whatever. God said, no, judgment's coming. You're so worried about why I'm using the Babylonians. He doesn't say why he's using the Babylonians. He only says, look, they're going to get theirs. And
that part's true.
And honestly, I mean, I appreciate what he did is what David does time after time after time in the Psalms. When David sees no hope and is mourning or in sorrow or suffering on his bed, he always concludes the Psalms with going, well, I don't know what you're doing, God. I don't see any hope for anything, but I'll trust in you and I'll... He always wraps up the Psalms like that. And I think Habakkuk is following basically a pattern here.
He might.
From the Psalms of
but
just...
But God does answer him. In fact, when he says, I see all this wicked and all that, every response here answers each one of his questions. So see, as I understand it, these responses are right to his charges. And every one of them responds to it. And in both the cycles. So I actually do see God responding in kind. It's not the way Habakkuk wanted it, but it's...
That's my point. It's not an answer, Habakkuk. I don't even think it's a satisfactory answer, but I'm saying from a human standpoint...
It's like Job.
Exactly.
I don't know that you mean it's not a satisfactory answer. It responds to each one of his charges They're not the way he would have wanted. But I think that's why he's a changed person here. Now he can rest and trust in God.
But he's. I don't think he's resting. I think anybody that goes, okay, well, I'll sit here and wait till they kick down the door and kill us all.
No, I think what he's saying is that where do I go? So I guess I just have to rely on you.
Right.
Well,
I think he started there by asking the question to God.
I disagree, but that's okay. I think he actually is answering his charges.
Yeah.
All right, Habakkuk is terrified. He has no other place to turn but God. So he puts his trust in God. That's a logical answer. We already read that. What made the difference? I think now he knows that God cares. The minute God responded to him, now he knows he cares. He knows that God's in control and not himself, because this is not the way Habakkuk would try to fix it. But it's God's way. He responded to Habakkuk in such an amazing way that Habakkuk knew he could not compete with God. He could never bring the Babylonians to bring about deliverance. And God's gonna. Habakkuk can trust in a God who can bring about these amazing things. I think he's learned. What do we learn from the book of Habakkuk?
That God does respond.
Okay. What else?
I think, so I like how at the end where Habakkuk comes to that humble position where may not have happened the way he wanted, but he rests in God's decision and strength, and we can learn to trust in God through that.
I like that Habakkuk realizes he can't compete with God because he can't do things like this, but God can. So I do think that's important. What do we learn about, or how are we like Habakkuk?
Well, I'm totally like Habakkuk.
I hope you like the last part of Habakkuk.
Well,
please.
See,
Well, hang on, that's good. What do we learn about God?
And I'm speechless. That's good.
What do we learn about God?
He wants our trust.
Okay.
But his ways are. His ways. And I don't want to say this in a fatalistic sense, because I believe prayer works and God listens to us. But that God's plans are absolute. And I mean, and honestly, even though the end is something Habakkuk doesn't like, he's got to sit and wait to be destroyed. To us, destruction is a terrible thing, and looking at a nation that comes in and puts fish hooks in people's noses and does all those horrible things, you wouldn't want to suffer through any of that. And yet, and this is something that's always also bothered me, it's the history of mankind and the history of God's people has seen such suffering that, I mean, heaven's got to be so incredibly wonderful compared to this place that it's nothing compared to the suffering, which is why Christ, looking ahead, could endure the suffering of the cross.
Sure. What do we learn about God through this?
He's committed.
What else?
He cares.
He's got a plan, and he's working his plan even though we don't see it.
Okay.
We just need to be faithful that his plan is the righteous one, not ours.
Okay. What else? Can't God do amazing things? In my mind, if he can bring about this Babylonians to do his will, to do what he needs to have done in Israel, that's in a God that I'd be willing to serve. You know, because he can do things I can't do. And I think that's amazing. How can we help our faith grow?
One thing we get to do in now, as I've experienced, you suffer because strong. You don't have to suffer, but that's what happened.
And fear can actually bring about some good things, can it?
The earlier we learn to have a healthy fear in God, the better.
Anything else?
I see relationship here. When Habakkuk is asking God and actually listening for answers.
Okay. let's have a little break. Let's make it a 6-minute break. Otherwise, we'll get it. All right.